Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSCL Salisbury, 89.5 FM, and WSDL Ocean City, 90.7 FM. Delmarva Public Radio.
Support comes from Coastal Hospice, fulfilling life's journey with comfort and dignity. Coastal Hospice provides care and support at home to patients and their families in the four lower shore counties by putting patients' needs first, before ability to pay. 410-742-8732 or online at coastalhospice.org.
Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Plans for a homeless shelter in Easton stirred up some serious opposition from local residents who feared what kind of impact it would have on their neighborhood. But the Easton Board of Zoning Appeals approved the project. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The vote on the location at 107 Goldsboro Street was good news for the Talbot Interfaith Shelter. And back in early May, a crowded meeting in the town office building saw a number of opponents express their fears about the impact of turning the bed and breakfast owned by Carla Howell into a homeless shelter. Some feared their property values would go down. Others saw the potential for danger from such a facility, and it might not fit into the neighborhood, they said. Well, joining us in our studios this morning are Jack Harrell, president of the Talbot Interfaith Shelter, and its executive director, Julie Lowe. And welcome to the program.
Thank you
very much,
Thank
Don.
You.
Well, let me first of all ask you, were you surprised at the opposition that you got, the crowded room there in the building? What did you think?
I wasn't surprised that there was opposition. I was somewhat surprised by the intensity of the opposition and the, as you said in your introductory remarks, the fear and anger, the emotional content of the opposition was somewhat of a surprise to me.
Julie?
I agree. I think they were pretty organized. They were represented by an attorney who had done a lot of work in various towns in the area. And they were intent on closing us down.
So how did this search get underway, and how did you finally decide on the spot in Goldsboro?
Well, we've been working in churches for the last 6 years in a rotating cold weather shelter from December to the springtime. And our objective has always been to move into a year-round long-term shelter. And we've been looking both for long-term goals to build something eventually, but more for an interim goal to expand to the year-round shelter as soon as we can. And we've, for the last 2 years, been looking for both rental and for sale property, and we came upon Easton's Promise, the bed and breakfast, which, from our point of view, is ideal for what we want.
So what was attractive about it? What stood out as opposed to any of the other locations?
Well, we're looking to expand to handle 12 to 15 people, including parents and young children. This is not only within walking distance of all the services within Easton, but the building itself, as you mentioned, was a bed and breakfast. So it's outfitted with 6 bedrooms, each with bath and showers. Air conditioning has a sprinkler system, which is a major issue in Talbot County, because the reason we're restricted to 5 people is that's all you can host without a sprinkler system. And so this has already got a wet sprinkler system installed. Has a very large kitchen, very large common areas. If we had to design a facility for the spaces we needed, it exactly fits our needs.
One of the people who apparently spoke out against this was Bob Shanahan. He's, I guess, with Shoreline Realty. Actually invited him on the program, but he declined. But one of the things he said, I guess he argued, he talked about that if a homeless shelter is put in an unstable area with depressed real estate values, it helps stabilize the area. If put in a stabilized area with extensive properties, it makes it less stable and those values decline. What about that argument?
These are assertions where there's limited evidence. There are a number of studies on the impact of homeless shelters and service generally transition housing of various kinds in various neighborhoods. There is very limited data on the number of times that these types of facilities have been placed in high-value, high-income levels, and that's partially because high-value, high-income levels have been more successful in preventing these from being there to start with, so the data sets are small. In the studies I've read, in most cases, regardless of income, and in my own experience in Washington, D.C., where I was involved in a couple of these elements, the impact has been negligible. There are so many other things that affect the housing market that a service-oriented transition housing is a minor impact.
Well, so what kind of neighborhood are we looking at here?
This is a zoned commercial, and there are several single-family homes, multifamily homes, several businesses on this block. It's a very diverse neighborhood, and that was one of the points brought up at the Board of Zoning Appeals deliberation, was that this is not a special residential community. It's very diverse. It has many houses from, you know, very well-kept to not so well-kept at all.
So what other kinds of buildings then around? I mean, are there some residential homes, or is there some shops, or what's
in the block that we're at the edge of, as Julie says, the commercial residential zone. The block that we're on, across the street is a bank, a parking lot, and Bob Shanahan's real estate firm. So they across the street on that block is all commercial. On the side of the street that we're on, we're the second out of four houses. The first house is a rental, multiple family. Our home, which is currently a bed and breakfast, a home that's been split into apartments, and a single family residential. So it's just that one block is a fairly mixed bag. But I think the message that we heard loud and clear is that the neighborhood is interested and very dedicated to improving. It's part of the historic district. They're proud of the neighborhood. They want it to look good, and we very much want to be a part of that. Our objective is to ensure that we not only maintain what the property looks like, but looks better, that we're a positive addition to the neighborhood, not a negative one.
One final thing about this, there was a suggestion that perhaps instead of being where it's located, that they might have been better located, say, some kind of warehouse. And the argument was put forward that it would be cheaper per bed, more ample space for parking, large bathrooms, areas to play for kids and so on. What about that suggestion and why this as opposed to, say, something like that?
I think what people don't understand about our program is that one of our main goals is to try and reincorporate people who have fallen on hard times into a neighborhood, to reincorporate them into a community that can support them, that can help them grow and become a contributing part of that community. If we're stuck out in a warehouse next to a field somewhere, that's not going to happen. And these are people just like you and me, who have had maybe a cycle of challenges that they just can't overcome, and they just need a little respite time, a little help to get back on their feet, and this is an ideal location to do that. Plus, any of those warehouses would cost a significant amount of money to renovate, to make fit our program and turn, you know, warehouse into bedrooms, etc. And Easton's Promise actually needs absolutely no renovations, no changes inside or outside, to accommodate our programs.
Go ahead.
Well, just adding to that, we probably see us both bristle a little bit when you start saying warehousing the homeless. The objective is not to isolate people who have had hard times and hard luck, but to integrate them into the community and make them into productive citizens. And we've been very, very fortunate and very successful in even the limited amount of social connection, social services we've been able to provide with our seasonal cold weather shelter, just hooking people up with job opportunities, with social service opportunities, mental health opportunities, making sure that they can access the benefits that they've that they're due. It's far easier to slip through the safety net than it is to climb back out. And we're there to assist people to do that. And removing them from the community, putting them in a warehouse where you can't see them and can't care for them is not the solution.
But one of the things that the board said that was, it felt was important to it was that there would be no real indication that this was a place for homeless folks. There would be no signage, no outside indication. I mean, and assuming to impact the local property values and how people feel, it's almost as if on one hand you want to putting people into this diverse neighborhood. On the other hand, you're hiding the fact, as it were, that they're homeless.
They are our guests. We treat our clients as our guests. We call them our guests. We're mm-hmm. providing service. They will come and go during the day as the tourists who stayed at the B&B came and went when it was used as a B&B. It should be pretty transparent, unless you knew that the people that were staying at that house were having their room and board paid for. Basically, if you looked at our homeless population and you looked at the volunteers who are caring for the homeless and you sit down with the evening meals, and you had to pick who were the volunteers and who were the homeless, you wouldn't, I mean, there's no big labels. I mean, these are people that look and act just like you and me and have had maybe no more bad decisions than you and I have had. Their outcomes have been worse. So I think some of the stereotyping and some of the fear, hopefully, as we go through this process, we're able to at least correct some of the perceptions. We can disagree on the facts, but the perceptions are difficult to deal with if they're totally erroneous.
Now, one of the attractions, I think, to the board is we indicated that this is not somebody that's coming in from the outside putting this together, but that you've been in the community for a long time, that you've been handling the issue of the homelessness, particularly during the winter months. What's been your experience in laying down that track record for the folks there and Talbot?
Well, we've been doing this for 6 years in Easton, in the historic district, exactly the same areas where we're proposing this bed and breakfast homeless shelter and transitional home. We have proven that we are very safety conscious and that we have over 500 volunteers who give their time and talents to us each winter. We have never had to call the police or had an incident where there was any negative response. We're very cognizant of the fact that we're in churches and we want to protect the property, and people treat both our guests and our volunteers treat those properties with respect, and we know that that's going to be same case at Easton's Promise.
One of the things that struck me as I was sort of looking at this story, I ran across a statistic which said that Easton ranked, or I guess it's sixth, Easton or Talbot, I guess Talbot County, ranks sixth in the lineup of American cities with the highest concentration of billionaires.
Yes.
I mean, and yet, how serious is the homelessness situation? I mean, are we looking at people who are very, very wealthy? And then there's, like, obviously some people who are just not doing well at all. I mean, is there, what's going on there?
Well, I think Talbot County has a higher concentration of the very wealthy than probably the counties further than Dorchester, Somerset, further down on the shore. But the working population looks pretty much like it does in the other counties. It has the same poverty problems. And that's the people we see, the waterman who is out of a job, the building construction person who's out of a job, the family who's gone through a tough divorce. These are the people we see there. So there is a very wealthy layer in Talbot County, but if you take the average income, is not an indicator of the level of poverty that exists.
Most of the wealthy folks have moved here from other areas. They have second homes. They've found that Talbot County is a beautiful spot to live. But the people we run into in the homeless shelter are folks who have lived here for years and years and years and just don't have the support system that some of the other folks do.
Is this a county and maybe a town of Easton, but a county where the very, very wealthy, and those are very, very poor, those people at home, they live almost virtually in the same universe, or do they separate out? Are those people who are wealthy, as we've indicated, are they aware that this is a problem here? Do they see it?
Some are, some aren't. This whole process is being made possible by a very large donation from an anonymous donor. We have people that provide extensive financial support. Some of our volunteers who come and cook meals themselves, very well-off people who care about the community. As Julie says, there are others who are not really integrated into the community, but it's people living very close to each other. They may not be aware of each other.
So where did the opposition, do you think, to this being placed there come from?
Well, even the opposition has been very supportive of Talbot Interfaith Shelter and the services we provide. And they have said pretty much to a person, if you had this someplace else, we would support you, we would volunteer, we would donate money, but we just don't think this is the appropriate location. I unfortunately think that any neighborhood is going to have that same feeling wherever we try to put the homeless shelter and transitional home. I just feel compelled to make ourselves be good neighbors in this community and hopefully reach out to the neighbors who are in fear and have trepidations about their property value. I understand all that. And we hope to mend those fences and be good neighbors and actually contribute to that neighborhood and make it a better place to live.
And I think where the fears and concerns are based upon erroneous perceptions, things that aren't true, we clearly have a dialogue and educational process where there are legitimate concerns, and there were legitimate concerns expressed on traffic and parking and screening, and we have to make sure that we're meeting our own standards and our standards meet the needs of the neighborhood. So we are hearing, we are listening, we are going to try to respond to the neighborhood concerns.
Was this just simply, do you think, just a not in my backyard syndrome?
There is that component. And the people who say those words, you know, I don't think this is the right place, don't want to be called NIMBYs.
Mm-hmm.
But there is certainly that component. Anywhere you would put a facility such as ours, there are going to be fears and perceptions that are maybe not based in fact. We see visions on the television of homelessness in cities, and that makes us fearful. The fact is that that is not the case in Talbot County and the Midshore. It's a totally different picture. And these folks are folks who actually work for some of those billionaires and millionaires, cleaning their houses, doing work on their landscape. You know, and it just they do cohabitate, but they don't really travel in the same circles. So it's hard for people to perceive the other side's views.
I was going to say, so what kind of folks do you find have become homeless in Talbot County? And how do they contrast with what we think of? I mean, are we seeing more women than men? Are we seeing more families? Obviously, we've been hit with the Great Recession, which certainly has produced a tremendous amount of homelessness as well as just sort of hardship in general. Give us a kind of sense about who these folks are.
Well, we can take turns on this one.
You go
ahead. We all have a basic story. And one of the actual strengths of our program, as Julie says, we have 500 volunteers. And to the person, the feedback I get as the host site coordinator for our church is that the experience of volunteering and actually talking to and getting to know and spending a few hours changed their view of what homelessness was. One young woman came and served a dinner in our church and was surprised to see that one of the homeless people was the father of a schoolmate of her daughter, who she had been standing for the last year in line at the school for the walkers. And this was somebody she knew. And she didn't know that he had lost his job, gone through a divorce, foreclosure on his home, and all the things he assumed would keep him from homelessness fell through in a very short order, and there he was. Well, and he's one of the success stories. By the end of of the winter season. He had another job, had an apartment, had moved on. But were we not there to be the temporary support during that transition, that descent could have continued, and who knows? And there's stories like that. I've met people that were nephews of people that I know in the community, and then they've just kind of run out the string of, as Julie says, of couch surfing. There's no more couches left in their family, and now they're back out. Or healthcare problems. One woman had a spouse and two brothers die in the same 3 month period. Medical issues, lost a job. So it's a sequence. The typical picture is a sequence of uncontrollable events that have catastrophic impacts, and the person has no place to go. And we want to be not only the place to go, but also the place that will turn that trajectory around.
One of the gentlemen Jack was just speaking of said to many people that the Talbot Interfaith Shelter wasn't just a bed and a meal, but a support group that helped him work through his issues. He was very depressed. He was very stressed out. And the fact that volunteers would sit with him after dinner and just talk him through some things and give him ideas of places to try and go and get help made a world of difference and just changed his whole attitude around so that he could get back on his feet, get his own apartment, get a job, and become successful.
Do these people, particularly the people who thought they were on the right track, and as you, the first example that you gave, do they find themselves shocked, surprised that this has happened to them?
Absolutely. I mean, part of the common denominator, I think, that I've seen in times of the shelter is the kind of that deer in the headlights look. How did this all happen? And each of the stories is different.
Right.
But each of them is a sequence of negative events, some their own fault. They may have been a bad choice, or some that weren't their fault. It could be their company folded.
Their landlord foreclosed.
Their uncle sold their boat, and so he has no, the waterman's job that he counted on wasn't there. And all of a sudden, there are people in this economy living closer to the line than we think and probably than they think. And it doesn't take too much to push them over the line. The question is, once you have nothing, is there a place that can help you rebound? And that's what we want to be.
Have you seen a change over the last, say, 5 or 6 years in the kinds of people that are coming to homeless shelters, given the kind of economic dislocation? I know I've talked to some other homeless shelters, and they've said they saw a greater number of families, for example, or
yes,
there might be a greater number of women, for example. I mean, what are you seeing, Julie?
We've absolutely seen more families, and right now in Talbot County, there is really no resource for a whole family where that they can stay and get help.
Why is that?
I think it's probably because it's a new, more of a new situation. It's hard to find funds to help people, and we're running into all the naysayers that don't like homeless shelters. There are several battered women shelters in more specific types of places, but for just a woman with four children or a family intact that has lost their support system, there is really no place for them to stay. So that is what we hope to provide with Easton's Promise.
Is there, one of the questions I had, particularly when I first came here about 10 years ago, because there was great discussion about the homeless, there were one or two people actually died during the winter, was the role of government. And I was surprised that government was not doing more. What kind of role is the government playing in Talbot County, and what kind of role should it play?
We receive no government funds. We're right. Strictly a volunteer, privately funded operation. I would say government involvement, and Julie chime in on this, is minimal compared to having come from Northern Virginia, Washington area, working with the homeless in that aspect, where a lot of volunteer organizations, but an awful lot of government support also. But part of the attraction of the area is low tax rates. Low tax rates mean low services, and part of the services that are not funded are human services. So if, and I think this, one of the things that I would say is you can't have it both ways. You can't say we're not going to pay taxes, let the volunteer organizations pick up the load, and then not let the volunteer organizations pick up the load. You can't have it both ways.
Julie, what do you think about the government role? That...
Well, I think we all realize that government funds are drying up. We have a great country in, you know, economic distress, and it's hard to find government funds. And when you do find them, it's very rigorous reporting. And I know for a fact that our county and our town support us greatly, but they have no funds to give.
Has there been any leadership taken on the part of government leaders in the county or the cities? I mean, have they, or have you guys sort of basically done it on your own?
We've done it on our own. I've seen a little more government involvement in Queen Anne's County with their homeless shelter. But for the moment, we've done it on our own. We would love to reach out to some of the government folks, the town council and the county council, and hope to have them engaged as we go forward. This is all, we have big plans, and there's an awful lot of work to do, and that's one of the things on the list.
Now, currently, you operate something like 8 shelter sites, particularly during the winter months. What are you doing for the particular that time of year that gets cold? With the involvement of the churches and so on?
Well, right now, we work with the Housing Commission of Talbot to provide apartments for families. We have 2 apartments right now. We're talking about adding a third. This is something that can get expensive, and this is another reason for purchasing Easton's Promise, so that we can put those families in our location where all the services are together. We can bring the community service agencies together to the table at that location to help each and every person in there with all their diverse needs get what they need to get back on their feet.
So as you look at this project, you've got this this homeless shelter. How quickly are things going to get moving? And you've now got the approval from the zoning appeals board. What happens next? What's the timeline here?
Well, I wish I could give you a precise timeline. That we're discussing that in the car on the way down. We have the permit. The permit can be and probably will be appealed to the circuit court. The people who have standing, who are people that have testified in the, as I understand it, in the Board of Zoning Appeals hearing, have 30 days to make an appeal. We don't know. We suspect an appeal will be made, but we don't know that. We are not going to close on the purchase of the house until we have a permit that's non-appealable. In other words, either appeals have been exhausted or appeals have been denied, because worst case for us would be to own a house that we couldn't use for its purpose. So best case, we would close in the July timeframe and be ready to go this fall, and then it slides from there. And there are several stages and appeals that are at least legally possible, and you'd have to talk to the people who were making appeals to know how determined they were. Now, it is important that the only thing that they can appeal on is the record of the hearing. There is no new evidence or testimony taken, as I understand, in an appeal.
Right.
So it's did the Board of Zoning Appeals follow its own rules and procedures and follow the law?
I mean, is it possible that this thing, if it moves through the courts, of course, you know, notoriously for being slow. I mean, if you just go up the chain, that this could be not just July, but we're talking about months or
possible.
Yeah. And what happens to the homeless while all that happens?
Well, the
you
cost.
Got plans, or?
I mean, we focus on the cost in our own aspect, but we did the. If you do the math, basically the difference between running a cold weather shelter as we did and running a shelter 365 days a year for 15 people as opposed to the 5 people in the homeless is about 4,000 nights a year, 4,000 to 5,000 nights a year where someone is out on the street. So that's the cost. And the cost of delay is that someone who could be in a shelter, could be receiving services, could be turning their life around, is out fending for themselves.
We've been speaking with Jack Harrell. He's the president of the Talbot Interfaith Shelter and its executive director, Julie Lowe, talking about the new shelter that they're hoping to have put together there in Easton. And we appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
My name is Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I play a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists. Whether it's alt country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa, there's music and interviews with Americana artists from lots of countries that may surprise you. So join me for the International Americana Music Show, Friday nights at 11 on WSDL 90.7.
Downtown revitalization, it's a term that has bounced around City Hall and Salisbury for literally decades. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. For most Salisbury residents who have chronically watched their city council members on PAC 14, every few years there are new plans. Some call for streetscaping, others debate the opening and closing of the plaza, and there's the perennial favorite, sell some of the city-owned parking lots. But City Council President Jake Day says there's more activity in downtown today than the city has seen in more than half a century. He says there are more restaurants, more real estate activity, and even the opening of the first retail stores in decades. But downtown often seems as if it's sliced up into independent sections with its wide parking lots and uneven streets. And walkability could be a key to bringing back this once thriving area. City of Salisbury held a walkability workshop this week to puzzle out this question, and one of the speakers was Dan Burden. He is executive director, the co-founder of the nonprofit Walkable and Livable Communities Institute. And according to his bio, he spent the last 35 years helping the world get back on its feet. And he joins us in our studios this morning. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let me first ask you, what is your definition of walkability? How do you define that in terms of how cities are planned or revitalized?
Yeah. Well, walkability is a term that didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago. It was never in the American lexicon. It was created because we made our communities non-walkable. Throughout all of human history, everything we've ever designed was to get the right scale, the right pattern, the right ingredients for people to walk. It's how people have always lived.
All right, get around.
Yeah. And then starting somewhere in the 1920s, the philosophy changed, a architectural feature called modernism that started to stress the automobile and that the automobile was going to be the savior of cities. Well, instead, it emptied them out and made it economically non-sustainable, created the sprawl patterns we see. And a lot of the unsustainable ways of trying to manage a city you can't manage. So walkability is a big part of the solution. To get back to that historic, time-honored way of designing cities around people, accommodate the car, but design the cities for people.
So how do you make that change, particularly with cities that are designed or have been a result of the automobile? I grew up in Los Angeles, which is an area in where really the automobile is how you get from one place to another. And if there are little downtowns, they are little small downtowns that you drive to. Yeah. You don't necessarily live near. How do you go from something like that, or at least in terms of suburbs, to getting some kind of walkability?
With difficulty. and seriously, all of our institutions, from banking to real estate to the incentives for how to do development, is still geared toward the past. And so we're in this period of transition where to go forward, we're going to have to change everything. And the world will look better. And what you're describing as a more vibrant downtown is just an indication that we're starting to think about the right things. We're not there yet, and that's what this walkability workshop is really going to do, try to bring together enough people that we can get a solid consensus going, get some collaboration, get people to speak the same language, not be afraid of the future, perhaps be more afraid of the past because it's not served us well. And here's the interesting thing is that 60% of the housing, the buildings, the shops, the everything that are needed in 2050 have not been built. So we're going to build ourselves out of this, but it's got to require a different pattern and a different way of looking at how we build walkable, livable, healthy towns again.
Well, one of the things here in Salisbury, which is sort of interesting, is that in the downtown area that you see now, back particularly where some of the parking lots are now, there used to be buildings with stores. And if you see some of the older photographs, you can see people walking around big stores, that kind of thing. Obviously, there's been a lot of clearing out in terms of the parking lots, clearing out some of those buildings. And at the same time, you've had the development to the north end of this city of gigantic big box stores, retail stores. And so that when people, say, in the city of Salisbury want to, say, go and buy something, they're going to go north to these big stores rather than necessarily go to downtown. How do you resolve that issue? And that's how this situation, I think, in part grew, because a lot of the north end sort of drained the business out so that you really didn't have the kind of attraction that you used to have in that downtown area.
Yeah, and it what we're talking about is transitional. It will take 20, probably even more years, but we're starting to see the seeds of downtowns coming back alive. And here's a really important point. For any town to succeed, it needs to hold on to more of its money and not send it off to Chicago or Tokyo. The big boxers are owned by very big corporate interests. And so they'll take all but about, I think it's 12% they'll leave behind. The rest of the money just disappears. A ma and pa shop, totally different. About 60% of the money stays in the local banks, the local dentist, the local everything, and recirculates and therefore drives the local economy. So as we revitalize our downtowns, make the streets healthy and inviting and exciting, connect well into the neighborhoods with trails and sidewalks, everything, then we're giving a retailer a fair chance to succeed. So those who are coming in now are the early pioneers, but that's what the demographics say everybody truly wants. The elders want to age in place. They want to stay here. They don't want to go somewhere else. They want their grandchildren here, but there aren't enough draws for their children to get good jobs seated and going. So the greatest news is that the millennial generation, the youngest, they don't want the suburbs. They don't want the old strips. They want to come back to real places where they have a choice in transportation. They can drive, but they can also walk or bike. And that's what's going to be the fuel that's going to get Salisbury really moving. And also important to understand, the cities that pick this up first win. The ones that can't get their act together, they're going to lose. They're going to lose more jobs. They're going to lose more opportunity. So I hate to say it's all about the built environment, because it's not just that. But the built environment has to come first. The streets, the trees, the place making. And that's what this workshop is going to be all about.
Because one of the things you talk about, you think that two things. One is that you should have higher densities near the town center, and then where it's appropriate to obviously have more density further out. How do you get that to happen? Because when I look at, for instance, our downtown, I mean, there are the neighborhoods that are nearby, but then as you begin to move out, and you've got a number of developments on as you move out towards the outer portions of the city, those are further away. How do you increase density? I mean, or is that a way to increase it at all? Because I mean, the buildings are already there.
Sure. Well, I think the key is you start with the central city, but if you don't really get that going, you don't have the funds to go out and start to rescue other places. Then you go to the locations that are mostly big box or strips right now, and you identify those good locations where you can get a true village going. And what that means is that the buildings are set back, that don't relate to the street. New buildings come in. You don't necessarily take the old buildings out, but new buildings come in. They're called liner buildings, and those are mixed use. And you're already starting to do a few of those. I've noted that, right. Certainly in the north end, more than the south end. But it's happening, and it's happening close to the university campus first. You know, you're seeing new buildings being built that are honoring the street rather than, doing the wrong thing for the street. So as the code of what is acceptable in the community changes, you're actually changing the incentives. So the next developer comes in. If you level the playing field by making the code to where all developers must do the correct thing, then every developer wins. But as long as it's just the bold or the pioneering developer comes in, they're not going to compete well. So it has to come with good governance too.
Now, you talk about being within, say, I think it's, say, to be best within something like an eighth of a mile, I guess it is, of, say, the downtown areas. And you've got an eighth and a quarter and a half and so on. Explain a little bit about that. Well, let's first of all explain a little bit about that concept first.
Yeah. The whole concept is if people are to walk, if that's to be a choice, then it's got to be a range that you can do it faster, easier, better by foot than you can getting in a car and hunting down a new parking space. A quarter mile is what we call the walk shed. That's the magic. Anything within a quarter mile of the heart of the community, people are going to walk in first choice. You can go then half a mile out. This is on a radius. You can go out half a mile, and it's only a 10-minute walk. And as long as it's beautiful, attractive, you don't have any ugly roads you have to navigate, that works beautifully. And a huge percentage of people will walk a 10-minute walk. And then you can go out 1 mile, and again, it's on the radius, and that's only a 20-minute walk. So if you make the connections in beautiful, charming, people will walk a mile easily. So it's all based on a quarter mile gives you the best density and place to put your density and the heart of all the things. Half a mile works, but even a mile, you'll see an increase in the value of everybody's home. As long as you start to work on the streets and make them attractive and fun and functional so that you have a choice, that you don't just get in your car to get across the street.
I can imagine me getting in my car, even if we're, well, I guess maybe a mile away, I don't know. But one of the things that's really interesting, particularly about this place, and a lot of listeners have heard this before, is that we obviously have a mall, an enclosed mall. And if you take a map of that mall and you place over the downtown area, you can see that that mall is actually much, much bigger in space and area and walking wise than, say, the downtown area. So then the question becomes, so why would somebody want to go to the mall and walk all those distances as opposed to, say, a downtown? My answer, at least from a gut standpoint, is, well, because the interior is designed that they want to stay there, that there are places to go, it's attractive, they've designed it so that you want to actually be there. So you may walk much longer distances, say, at that mall than you would in downtown, but it's much more enjoyable. It doesn't even seem as much like as much effort. How do you take an area like downtown that we have, which seems, as I indicated in the opening of the program, that's kind of sliced up in all these roads, and we'll get to Route 50 in a moment. How do you make that as attractive as, say, just going to the mall?
Think about how the malls were created. The malls were created to become the attractive place for shopping. And as they did it, they followed all the great rules of town making. They put terminating vistas at each end. You knew that if you walk this way, you'll get to Sears, or this one at one time, JCPenney is now, you know, someone else. It was a controlled environment. The shop owners obeyed by the rules. You're going to open by this hour, and you're not going to close early. You're not going to go off and play golf in the middle of the day. So they became predictable. So everything that people want in a downtown was copied in the malls. But as they became successful, they drained the life out of the downtowns. And therefore, the assuredness and the quality started to fall off. And then it's a hit or miss as to whether or not you get the real payout of going to a downtown. Now, that's what's starting to reverse itself. We're seeing many, many mall businesses, that is, the corporations that run them, saying they're never going to build another one. And instead, they're... Even Walmart is now saying they built the last of their big boxers, that they now want to come back to where people want to shop, which is downtown. Now, they wouldn't be able to come in at the scale they've been out in the burbs, but they can be very successful as long as they're the right size, the right scale. We see Target doing it first. I think Walmart's coming in a little later, but Target's got some beautiful stores in the downtowns of places like Stanford, Connecticut, and quite a number of other locations. So we're going to see that, stores will be more appropriately scaled so that they don't form what we call a super block. Mm. When you make your buildings too big, they destroy the fabric of a community. So we're going to see some real desire, some real competition for all the stores, including the corporate-run stores, want to be in downtown.
Do you think you need some kind of anchor? I know when I was talking to the mayor of Berlin just about 4 weeks ago or so, and they got named as the coolest small town in America. But I asked them about how they revitalized their downtown, because at one point, as he told me, he says there were probably more stores that were closed than were open, and they all got together and said, well, what are we going to do? And one of the keys the mayor said was we needed an anchor. In their particular case, it was an old hotel where they kind of exposed it back out to the street, and it began then to generate some activity. Do you need an anchor or two anchors for a downtown area to come back, you think?
You do. You need a real sign that the town is turning around, the downtown's turning around. And I worked in many small towns. Greenville, South Carolina is one I'm thinking of, where they brought back a five-star hotel. That's a real indicator that people are ready to make the investments. With one good investor, others follow. And It can be a chain store, it could be a national brand, but it can also be a real commitment by a number of investors, developers in the community, restoring an old hotel, giving it a brand new, fresh name. And that's the sign people are waiting for. They want to see that they're not going to be out there alone. And so you can see almost to the town, those that have turned around have made that investment, gotten a sharp business person to know how to run a good business, to come back to a downtown, and then start that spark. And after a while, it spreads like wildfire.
How important are tax incentives to all of this? Because, a number of years ago, I remember reading about tax abatement programs and so on, and there were a lot of cities that went that way, and they didn't really get much for their money. I mean, they either lost money and their revitalization didn't occur. Whereas there were other cities in the same era where they didn't give tax abatements and they had great downtowns. And one of the keys was the sort of the infrastructure and the labor force, a lot of other things to bring employers in. How important do you think it is for tax incentives as opposed to, and obviously you have to be very careful about not giving away the store, as it were.
Yeah. You know, finance is not my background, but
I pay
a lot of attention that the incentives to continue to go out and put in the next store in the strip are much stronger than they are to come back downtown. So what is needed downtown is any set of incentives that make it the natural choice. So just as an example, if the town code currently calls for so much parking for a store of a given size in the downtown, first thing you do is you get rid of any parking requirements. There are no requirements downtown. It's a parking-free zone in the sense that you don't have to provide any. You can figure out what the market is and provide some, but don't destroy the downtown by reinforcing a suburban standard on your downtown. And that's what most towns have done. And you may still be there. You may have already said, no, we're not going to force parking downtown. We're going to let it naturally work itself out. Then there are so many other incentives. But the big thing is you can't try to incentivize one thing like the downtown if you're pushing all the incentives out to the suburbs. Mm. And so that's what's got to stop. Every person who looks at how to succeed with a banker, with other investors and so on, looks at those models that have worked up until now, and all the incentives are drawn for sprawl. What we now need is a whole bunch of incentives, and they can be tax incentives, but they can be any of other incentives to come back downtown and to make those investments and to win and to know that you'll win and convince bankers. And sometimes it's just getting one good banker to realize that they should be giving loans out for entrepreneurs, write a good business plan, that are going to make it. We worked recently in a little town in Arkansas called Batesville. And the people who brought me in were the bankers. They got it. They understood. So they collected their money, said, let's bring this guy in. Let's transform our Main Street. They did. And they're really starting to pick up energy. Didn't require any government money. It just required somebody to say, we're tired of writing all our loans for suburban businesses. We want to write loans for downtown.
In terms of parking, what kind of relationship should there be to parking? I mean, some of the parking lots, as a matter of fact, were created because they felt there wasn't enough parking for the buildings that were there. And of course, they tore down some other buildings and so on. How do you do that? Because right now we have sort of these big swaths of parking lots. Yeah. And one of the things that about the parking lots is that they really do separate out individual buildings and facilities. For instance, if you go from, say, downtown and you go through a building and you come out and you see a gigantic parking lot, and then way off to the side you can see a couple of restaurants. Now it looks like a long, and I got to tell you, from that perspective, it looks like a long walk, as it were, because you got to go to the parking. What kind of relationship in terms of space do you think is required?
The big problem of almost any downtown is we've had really bad parking policies. The problem I found in almost every town I've been to is there is no parking problem. There is a parking management problem. Shop owners that park right in front of their own store. No way to manage the parking. And I haven't had the chance to study your setting yet. But giving away free parking is the worst thing you can do. And where shop owners say, no, if we charge for parking, we're not going to be able to make it. What the customer wants is assurance that they're, if they pull into a parking space, it's going to be there. They don't mind paying a quarter or 50 cents or even more if they have that assurance. And again, it's far more convenient than parking in some remote parking place in the mall.
Right.
Downtowns have the natural fabric to win if we just stop punishing the customer that wants to come there. And you're right. You've got to get rid of a lot of these eyesore parking lots. They're a real blemish on what is a great classic historic town pattern.
Now, here in Salisbury, one of the things that happened was that they wanted to have this sort of bypass Route 50, and it cuts right through the center of town. Now, one of the ideas, by the way, behind this was that they do have a turnoff for Salisbury's downtown. However, very few cars actually use it. They're just like speeding down the highway to Ocean City. It's not enough for them to get off the road and say, "Oh, we're going to stop." And that road, by the way, cut off the other houses, the suburbs, were the housing tracks on the other side, because it used to be you'd be able to walk or you walk to the downtown area. Now you've got to cross this gigantic busy street. And you've got a number of sections that are sort of like that, and that chops up, as it were, downtown. How do you remake downtown when you have those kinds of what seem to be permanent fixtures that you've got to work around?
The idea of doing a bypass and getting the traffic out of the actual downtown would have been a good idea if it had been done right, but it was done by engineers who had one performance measure on their mind, and that is how fast can they move the traffic. So they designed the roads where motors go so fast that they don't even notice there's a downtown in the town. And so the first big step is to redesign Route 50 to be a true boulevard, to be a street where as you approach the downtown, the speeds become less and less until when you're in the core of where you would turn into downtown, the speeds may be no higher than 20. That calls for new tools, different ways to design intersections, lots of trees, beauty, charm. You start with some liner buildings a ways out, and the liner buildings being bringing the buildings to the street edge, mm-hmm. as you do in a classic downtown, and really start to have the road read that you're only supposed to go this speed. It's not done with signs. One would wish that it would be that cheap. No, it's got to be done with love. And the love is putting in the design so that people want to be in that space, and they want to take their time getting to that space, and they want to park right there. And the interesting thing is, when we start to use the right tools, the regional motors that doesn't want to go into the downtown, right. actually gets through that area faster than they do today.
By the way, how important are trees?
Trees are vital to the life of a city. We have undervalued, underrated them in every possible way. The figure I like to use, and this comes from the U.S. Forest Service, an urban street tree, that is a tree that gets to live near a street, is probably a $300 to $600 investment. Maybe a little more if you really do really good things for the tree. In its lifetime, it will return back to the city $60,000. And that's in energy savings, prolonging the life of asphalt, everything. It has nothing to do with the beauty and the sanctuary for birds and insects and all the things we love to have in a city. But yeah, you can't put in anything that's going to give you a higher rate of return.
So what does it take to revitalize the downtown in terms of the city itself? Some cities have said what they did was they got their people together and they had a vision, or they said, we've got to do this and these are our strategies. And it's not just, say, Berlin, but a number of other downtowns have done the same thing. What does it take to get that kind of human capital together to determine that you're going to revitalize a downtown?
Well, Don, you used the right word, human capital. Everybody fusses around, do we have enough financial capital? We've got more financial capital than we need in this country. What we lack is the human capital, what we call social capital, a willingness for people to work together, to come, to become educated, to reach that common ground, to where the retailers realize what's in their best interest rather than just arguing off the hip from things that they're afraid of. So that's the key, to come up with workshops. Charrette is a style of a longer thing than a workshop. It might take a week or so, that brings people together to help design it. But it's the people who are designing it, the retailers, the people who live in the neighborhood, anyone who has a financial stake. They're the designers, aided or assisted by planners, architects, and engineers. We don't let the professionals design our city. We need to design it ourselves. I can give you a great case study.
Go ahead.
A town I had never heard of, Lancaster, California.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty good-sized town, about 130,000, I believe, population. Invited me in to start working on a bike plan. And I saw their downtown and my jaw dropped. It was the most beautiful downtown I had ever seen. And I knew that it had formerly been a strip through their downtown, kind of like Route 50 here. And I walked into the city council. They were waiting for me. And my surprise just must have been beaming or something. And they were looking at me a way I've never seen people look at me before. And they said, Dan, you inspired this. You told us we could do this. At a conference 10 years earlier, they were there. And they hired a great architectural team to come in to work with their people to come up with this new street. They've already seen $900 million of new buildings come to their downtown. And that's what it's all about. People working together with some professional assistance, but it's the people that make it work.
How do you avoid the what seems to be like the false starts? I mean, because we've had a number of committees and so on, and they've come up with streetscapings and a number of other things, and then they kind of like go for a while, and then it just doesn't take off. I mean, is there a sustainability or approach to getting all these people together to actually move forward? And there's also, too, I might add, there's also stresses and strains in terms of the growth of the city, where some people want things to stay exactly the same, or they're worried about one issue as opposed to another, all because there's been growth. We've seen that that tension, too. What about that?
Well, the other commonality I see in all the cities that are making it is finding a leader that's going to stick with it, whether it's an elected leader, person who's a business leader or whatever. In Batesville, Arkansas, the person is a retired admiral who just knew about leadership, and he knew how to bring people together, to hold them together, to work with the Chamber of Commerce, the retailers, and so on. And typically when I go into a community, that's all I'm looking for, is which person in this audience today is going to emerge as a leader that cannot be stopped. And it's got to happen from internally that way. No outsider can come in and build a city and give you every idea in the world. It doesn't stick. You've got to have a true leader emerge from a workshop like the ones this week or some future effort. But you've got to find that leadership, and that person is going to really turn things around. I just came from East Aurora, New York, a beautiful town, home of the arts and crafts movement. We totally remanufactured their principal streets, and now they're just charming. It was one woman that took that charge, and she's been with it for about 10 years. She's now leaving. She and her husband found a job in another place altogether, but she made that work, and all it took was those 10 years. And now, of course, you're going to have to search for a new leader.
Right.
But that's what Salisbury's going to have to do, is find who is willing to turn this town into the future.
And how do you get, how do you get all these disparate elements to work together? I mean, we have tensions over homeowners and landlords and all. I mean, and I'm sure you've seen it all. How do you weld those people who have this conflict? An inherent conflict, seemingly.
A good leadership team figures that out. The leader doesn't work alone. They create a team, and that team figures out, oh my gosh, we're arguing over some pretty petty things. Let's find a better way to decide what color our benches are going to be. Right. And by doing that, be able to, one by one, set aside those who are afraid of change, bring them into the process. And you don't bring them all in at once because, you know, you have to find what appeals to each group. But over time, when someone from the community knows why you're changing the way an intersection works and can explain it, it's a lot better than some professional engineer or planner trying to come in and explain the same thing, maybe even using the same words. It's got to be homegrown.
We've been speaking with Dan Burton. He is director and co-founder of the nonprofit Walkable and Livable Communities Institute, and was in town here in Salisbury for a walkable workshop. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you, Don. A pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.